You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, one of Hollywood's newest movie directors joins us to talk about growing up in Wisconsin and how his debut film explores grief and loss through the story of a missing truffle pig. Now, Wisconsin is the most prolific producer of cranberries in the United States. In 2019, the USDA says the state's yield added up to almost 4.7 million barrels. But what does climate change mean for Wisconsin's official state fruit? Researchers are trying to find ways to adapt cranberry growth to changing temperatures. Amaya Atucha is an associate professor of horticulture with UW-Madison. She also serves as part of the UW Fruit Program as a fruit crop production specialist. She recently talked about her work with WPR host Lee Rayburn.
Amaya, let's begin with how important cranberries are to Wisconsin. How do cranberries contribute to Wisconsin's economy?
Well, cranberries are extremely important to Wisconsin. First of all, because cranberry is one of the very, very few fruit crops that are native to North America. And we have a lot of wild cranberries here in Wisconsin. So we have quite a bit of genetic diversity, which is basically, you know, finding like a mine gold in one sense, but also because Wisconsin is the top producer of cranberries in the world, and it contributes substantially to the economy of the state, whether it's through the fruit that it's, you know, sold, but also for job generation and also for agritourism. So many people come and want to see a cranberry marsh and want to look at the harvest. So it's not only important from an economic point of view for the state, but it also is an identity. It's our fruit crop for the state. It's our native fruit crop in North America, one of the most important. And so, yeah, it's very important.
So then give me some idea of how climate change is affecting our cranberry crops.
Well, climate change is affecting all of our crops. But one of the things that I think that in general people don't realize is that cranberries, very similar to other fruit crops, is a perennial crop. So these are plants that can live for many, many, many years, 25, 50 years, you can have a productive bed of cranberries. That's the kind of like the production unit. So when you have a perennial plant that has to survive many winters and many growing seasons, the effect of climate change is substantial because it accumulates over time. So some of the things that we see with climate change are, for example, these very extreme weather conditions, whether it's during the growing season with heat or during the winter with cold. And so when we have those swings of temperatures, the plants really have to adjust and find mechanisms to survive, whether it's freezing conditions or really high temperatures. And how do they do that? How do they adapt? Not all plants have evolved in that climate change situation, so they might not necessarily have the capacity to adapt. And that's why that's when we start to see some yield losses and some other problems that kind of arise. So extreme weather temperatures, extreme precipitations, things that we see during the growing season, during the spring or during harvest time, these downpours of rain really affect the quality of the fruit. It also, you know, gets this microclimate around the vines and the fruit that increases a pathogen development. So that's another thing that we see. We see that with a little bit more of a warmer temperatures during the nights in the fall and the summer, that affects, for example, the development of color in the fruit. So that's another thing that we see with climate change. So there's many aspects of fruit production because this is a perennial crop that are affected due to climate change. When we think about climate change, many, many times we read in the news things about, you know, corn, soybean, or annual crops that they're only present during the growing season, during the spring, the summer, a little bit of the fall. But here, when we're talking about cranberries, this is a perennial plant that lives many, many years and has to also survive the winter. So changes in the winter due to climate change substantially affects the production of cranberries.
Amaya Atucha, our guest, she is an associate professor with the UW-Madison. And Amaya, as things stand, how sustainable will the growth of cranberry crops in Wisconsin be in the next, say, 10 years?
That's our job security as scientists, no? We're always trying to find solutions. How can we work this problem out? How can we find a solution? And so things that we do here at UW I want to say I want to recognize there are many other scientists at UW-Madison working on cranberry. We have a really, really good relationship, strong relationship with the cranberry industry. And we work together to strategize and figure out what are our research priorities. How can we figure out solutions for things like climate change? So one of the things that my lab in particular works on is cold. And it's the perfect place because of Wisconsin. And cranberries are perfect because they are a perennial crop. And so we look at understanding how the plant adjusts to cold. What changes is the plant using to be able to withstand, you know, these sub-zero temperatures that we sometimes have in January and February? And once we can discover what are the mechanisms that these plants are using, we can figure out ways of evaluating that. And that's where the diversity in genetic resources and wild plants comes into play. How can we find individuals that are more adapted to these changes in temperatures? Can we find individuals or genetic, differently genetic individuals that might have more cold resistance, for example? Or if we're looking at other things like heat during the growing season, some plants that might be more adapted to higher temperatures. And once we find those individuals and we're able to evaluate them, we can integrate these traits through breeding, through traditional breeding. And that's where UW and the team of scientists that we have in UW, we all work together. Some of us works on maybe identifying some of those mechanisms, what others work on, how can we incorporate it into new cranberry cultivars that we want to release that will be able to withstand these changes in climate in the next 25 years.
So what have we learned so far through this research, through the team of researchers, through the grant of the USDA? What are we finding about cranberries in Wisconsin through cold weather and how they can survive?
Well, we've found some of the work that my lab has done and some of my graduate students, especially a PhD student that just graduated, Camilo Villota. He did a lot of work looking at the mechanisms in which specific structures that contains the flowers during the winter survived freezing temperatures in the winter so that they can have flowers the following year and we can have fruit. And so with that mechanism, once we found out what's happening there, how the plants are able to adapt, we now are looking into testing a big germplasm that we have, that this is a collaboration with our colleague, Dr. Juan Salapa, who is a USDA IRS scientist, but is also a professor in the Department of Horticulture at UW-Madison. So we work together at trying to evaluate some of the germplasma. We also have another researcher working in the team, is Dr. Josh Namura, also a USDA IRS scientist, but also a professor here in the Department of Horticulture. And we're looking at what are specifically some of these molecular, very, very specific mechanisms. Can we measure them? And then once we have identified that, can we, again, cross those individuals with some others that have, for example, better fruit quality or produce more fruit? And we can come up with this super cultivar of cranberries that are not only adapted to climate change, but also produces high yield of high quality. So that is sort of like how we build up a team of solving a problem. In this particular case, is to adapt cranberry cultivars to climate change in Wisconsin.
Amaya Tucha studies the physiology of fruit crops like apples, grapes, and cranberries as an associate professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She's also a fruit crop production specialist in the UW Fruit Program. So where are we then, Amaya, in the process of solving this? Where are we in getting the farmers what they need for the best cranberry crop that Wisconsin can provide?
I wish I could tell you we're going to have a new cultivar right away, but research takes time. And so we are, I think that we're far from developing some of these. I mean, maybe, 5 years from that, but we are in the process of doing it. We already started. And as with every research project, there's always new questions that come up. The more you learn about it, the more questions come up. So there's always side research projects that are coming off of our original idea. So I would say, yes, we will not have a solution right away. This, if we had maybe the resources that other scientists have to develop things like the COVID-19 vaccine, maybe we could accelerate the process. But the truth is that we have, limited resources, and we are only, a small little group of researchers working in Wisconsin to try to solve this problem for a very specific industry, which is great. I mean, it's great that we are able to do that because other crops don't even have that possibility. But we're making slow but steady progress into trying to help our cranberry Wisconsin industry.
Well, I am curious now, Amaya, what would you still like to learn about the cranberry?
Oh, there's so many other things. As I was saying, it's true that we have problems during the winter with cold, and that's one that we're addressing, but we also see that we're having problems with heat. One of the problems that other researchers are looking into is how this heat might also affect the development of certain diseases. So working with the plant pathologists or even working with the fruit crop entomologists are looking how these high temperatures during the growing season might also probably affect some of the pests that we might have. That is a very interesting question, just to look at the entire system, not only from the perspective of the plants, but also what happens with the pathogens and also what happens with the insects and how that affects the overall yield.
Amaya Tucha, thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
That was UW-Madison Associate Professor Amaya Tucha talking to WPR host Lee Rayburn. They looked at the effects of climate change and the growth of cranberries here in the state. Up next on Central Time, a meteorologist explains the unseasonably high temperatures and dangerous winds ripping across the U.S. from Mexico to Michigan and what to watch for here in Wisconsin. This is Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Now, for the second week in a row, a huge swath of the U.S. from New Mexico to Michigan is experiencing unseasonably high temperatures and winds. The National Weather Service called today a historic weather day, referring to a storm system that'll come through and bring winds of up to 70 or 80 miles per hour in some places. We're talking now about potentially dangerous winds and unseasonable warmth here in Wisconsin and in much of the rest of the central U.S. Tim Halbach is the Warning Coordination Meteorologist for the National Weather Service in Milwaukee. Tim, welcome back to Central Time.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, safety first, Tim. What kind of things should people be thinking about this evening on into the night when it comes to their personal safety and this weather coming?
Well, the main hazard is going to be the winds. It's going to be a little different than some of the thunderstorms that we see over the summer where you get this brief, 30-second to 1 minute long burst of winds. We're looking at a pretty prolonged period of high winds that the main hazard is going to be if any trees or structural damage type things happen because of this prolonged wind. So some of the people that might be a little bit more prone to, being in the elements would be if anybody's out driving around and a tree falls down and they either run their car into it or falls on top of the car. Or if you're in the top level of a house and you have trees around, that the winds could potentially blow them down into the top parts of the house. So that's our main concern with this happening overnight. And, everybody's going to be sleeping at that time while these storms come through. So that's our main concern going through tonight.
And we're watching this rip across the country now, some reports of heavy winds in Colorado and things making their way eastward now. What have we seen so far today?
So far, where the system started in eastern Colorado, it's already gone through all of Nebraska. It's right to the Iowa-Nebraska state line, and they've had 107 mile-per-hour winds in parts of Colorado down in the southeastern portion of it. Right now, there's a number of tornado warnings going on right along the Missouri River in eastern Nebraska. So a bunch of confirmed tornadoes there and a lot of high winds. So this is going to move further to the northeast and cause some issues for parts of Wisconsin tonight.
Is there a concern about tornado risk here in the state?
The main tornado risk would be up in the northwestern part of the state, where we're kind of watching what's happening right now and trying to translate out how long that's going to take to get into northwestern Wisconsin. And the conditions may not be as prime as what they are right now, but that would be the main area for that concern. And with the conditions we're seeing, it's going to be fast-moving storms that could produce some long-track tornadoes. But it's one of those forecasts where you hope it doesn't really pan out. But in terms of of that potential for tornadoes. It'd be up in the mainly the northwestern part of the state.
And Tim, I know sometimes if we hear, okay, probably not tornadoes, just straight line winds, we might not take it as seriously. Those straight line winds can be a serious hazard, right?
Yeah, and that we try not to say, you know, just straight line winds, because it happens over a much larger area. And with this, it's going to be such a prolonged wind and a strong wind that it's going to cause quite a few, damage to trees and all that. The one thing we have going for us right now is that the trees aren't leafed out. So that helps to maybe not create as much drag when the wind is trying to blow through the trees. But regardless, when you're looking at the potential for 60 mile per hour winds for a prolonged period of time, that's going to knock a lot of trees over, or, you know, we're expecting it to, at least.
Talking to Tim Halbach, warning coordination meteorologist for the National Weather Service in Milwaukee, talking about this unusual December weather on the way into the state this evening and overnight, bringing heavy winds. Tim, big picture, what is going on here? This isn't a normal Wisconsin December kind of storm. What's driving this pattern?
Well, it is an unusual pattern. Very strong southerly flow that's brought a lot of moisture up from the Gulf of Mexico. So typically something that you'd see, you know, summertime, not typically in the winter, but it's had a big source of warm air from the south that's been pulled up, and the weather system itself is so strong that it can pull all this moisture up into Wisconsin, even when typically it wouldn't get this far north. I was kind of talking with some other folks, kind of reminiscing about January 2008. I happened to be working down in the Chicago area, and we had similar conditions like this where it was so humid and we ended up getting the tornadoes in southeastern Wisconsin that day. But kind of a similar thing where if you can get a lot of strong southerly flow out of the Gulf of Mexico region, you can have this type of weather. The weather doesn't really care what time of year it is. If you get the right conditions, you can get this type of severe weather and strong winds.
And I remember looking at the weather for this week and just seeing, 60 degrees coming up for just one day this week. That'll be nice, but that can be kind of a red flag this time of year, right?
Yeah, you really shouldn't get 60s this time of year. If you are, you know that there's something significant that's potentially happening there to be able to make that happen. And we're seeing that today and the impacts of what's going to happen there with the strong winds and the severe weather.
Can you talk about the timeline? When is the advance part of this wind going to be moving through parts of the state from west to east, or I guess southwest to northeast?
Yeah. So what we've been telling people is it's this evening, it's going to be windy, and then it's going to get really, really windy when the line of showers and storms move in. And then we're going to have a long period of prolonged strong winds. And this looks like it'll all start the first really big surge of winds will be entering the western part of the state, maybe around 8 or 9 this evening. And it's going to fly across the state. It's going to basically be through to the eastern part of the state by about midnight tonight. But then after that first wave comes through, if you're watching radar or anything tonight, once you see that move through, we're going to have this prolonged period basically until 6 or 9 o'clock in the morning tomorrow, where we're going to have 30 to 50 mile per hour winds, possibly even still some of these gusts up into the 60 mile per hour range. So long duration, strong winds, and just not a lot of fun.
And what's on the other side of those winds when it comes to temperature here in the state? I'm guessing we're not going to come through this staying at 60.
No, we might break a record for tomorrow if our temperatures are still at this level at midnight tonight. But then by the time you get up tomorrow morning, unless you're awake all night because you can't sleep because of the wind, it'll be dropped down into the 30s pretty quickly by tomorrow morning. So it's not going to be long lasted tomorrow.
Are you looking for people to share information about damage in their community?
Yeah, so you can report to us either through our Facebook or Twitter page, or if you're a storm spotter, you know where to go to be able to report to us. But yeah, any damage that ends up occurring, we don't want people out in the middle of the night searching around for anything. But if you get up in the morning and you see some tree branches down or any kind of damage, we appreciate the report so that we can inform other people that damage did occur.
And you mentioned, of course, with trees coming down, that'll be an issue, and that can lead to power outages. Are there recommendations from the Weather Service on how to prepare for, what to do about those down lines and power outages?
Yeah, I would keep a flashlight handy that you can, when the power goes out, or if the power goes out, you'll be able to, be able to see in your house. If you, have to get up in the morning, most people on a Thursday will, put batteries in your alarm clock so that when the clock goes out, you're not late for work. And if you feel like if you got a lot of large trees around your house, a safety thing might just be to maybe not sleep on the top level of your house. I know with my family, I think we're going to have a sleepover in the basement tonight, just because my kids don't sleep well in the wind anyway. So might as well, play it safe and just be down in the basement for tonight for us.
And just in our last minute, this, of course, comes on the heels of this tragic tornado that killed at least 74 people in Kentucky, also other states. What are we still learning about that very long-lived tornado?
We're still surveying the damage on it because it was such a long tornado. And, it's been a while since we've had something like that. But, we still got a lot of work to do in terms of preparedness and making sure people know what the different type of tornado warnings mean from the Weather Service. There's still work to do to try to help people be aware that dangerous tornado is coming their way.
And are we going to see a return? This is two bursts of unseasonable, dramatic weather here in December. Are things going to look more like a normal December just in our last few moments?
Yeah, it looks like we're going to be a little bit closer to normal for being a little bit colder, and then maybe a little bit of warm up right before Christmas, but generally nothing to this level in the 60s or anything like that.
Tim, thanks again for joining us today.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Been talking to Tim Halbach, Warning Coordination Meteorologist for the National Weather Service in Milwaukee. He joins us to talk about historic winds and storms making their way through the central United States today, as we heard, on their way into Wisconsin, the beginning of the winds this evening, the worst of it going on overnight as well. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, the head of Wisconsin's Transportation Department joins the program for a look at road, highway, and other transportation spending and what the federal infrastructure bill is going to mean here in Wisconsin. And you, as always, can join in with your thoughts and your questions for the head of the Transportation Department and what you want to see that money go to. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. From Star Wars to Selena to a circus parade from 1902, there are 25 new inductees into the National Film Registry. As reported by NPR, the Library of Congress adds movies to that registry each year to preserve them for the future. The selections are made based on things like cultural impact or historical value and rarity. The newest selection in this week's class was the movie WALL-E from 2008, the oldest rare 1902 footage of a Ringling Brothers circus parade through a black neighborhood in Indianapolis. Other more rare selections include the 1926 movie The Flying Ace, produced by a black film studio in Florida. Some of the biggest names include Star Wars Return of the Jedi and the first movie in the Lord of the Rings trilogy. And of course, there's a 1984 movie with a significant impact on my life, or at least my sleep patterns, A Nightmare on Elm Street. See the full list at npr.org. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, an award-winning Christmas decorator from Milwaukee shares tips on making an impressive holiday lights display and saving money while we're at it. Now, one of the best-reviewed movies of the last year has ties to the Badger State. Pig stars Nicolas Cage as a reclusive truffle hunter who sets out to rescue his pig after it's stolen. The story takes place in Portland, Oregon, but the director hails from Wisconsin. Michael Sarnowski is the director and co-writer of Pig, his first feature-length film, which is now streaming on Hulu. He recently talked to Central Time's Dean Kinetter.
Michael, you're from here in Wisconsin, just outside of Milwaukee. When you were growing up here, what first got you interested in movies and making films?
I think the earliest experience I had with it was, I think University School of Milwaukee, they had a summer camp that had a film course where I think we were just using iMovie and little handy cams I think Drew Maxwell was the teacher of that. I still remember him. He worked at the school as well. We would just make little movies over the summer. I think I was probably in like sixth grade or something. That was my first experience realizing that, you know, films were something you could make and that there was a craft to it and that you would set up the camera in different areas and all that sort of thing. But then after that, it was a gradual process of, you know, different teachers and my mom being really encouraging of it. It was never really something I pursued beyond a hobby. It was just kind of something I would do with my friends. I didn't think that it was sort of a career that I could pursue. So that didn't come until much later. But early on, I had enough teachers and people that were supportive of that passion that it was a hobby that I got to explore.
What led you to make the jump from looking at it as a hobby to an actual profession?
Mostly time. I mean, it wasn't until senior year of college that I really shot my first, I mean, I wouldn't exactly say professional film, but it was a film with more than just me and a handy cam. I had a couple friends who were, you know, being crew members and we had lights and sound and all that sort of stuff. And that was the first time that I ever shot something that felt more professional. And that was when I was kind of like, oh, maybe this is something I could kind of pursue outside of college as more than just a hobby. But then it took me some years to kind of feel like I had deserved or could be in sort of Hollywood. It seemed very far away from me. I didn't have any contacts in the industry. So it was, you know, it was a good chunk of my 20s just kind of wandering around LA and in the dark, not literally in the dark, but just trying to figure out like what people wanted from me. And then I think it wasn't until I kind of stopped worrying about what people wanted from me and just started focusing on trying to really write something that meant something to me, that I finally kind of had, my big break. That was Pig, when I wrote something that just was kind of just for me, just something that really spoke to me. I mean, that's sort of a sloppy answer, but it took time to kind of believe in myself and feel like it was an option.
Let's turn to the movie Pig. On the most basic level, it's a story about a truffle hunter who sets out to rescue his kidnapped truffle pig. But beyond that, it's this really thoughtful story about grief and loss and how we, you know, fill the voids in our life when we lose people that we love. When you were writing the film, what came first? Was it the premise or was it that theme?
The first thing was the premise. The first thing was just this image of this old man in the woods with his truffle pig. That was something that I had kind of had in a notebook somewhere for a while as just an image that stood out to me. I didn't know much about truffles, but there was just something about that, I think the writing process was about unpacking why that image was so moving to me. And then it was through unpacking that I think I found kind of my own thematic stuff from my life that fed into why that was so meaningful to me. And then I started getting into, you know, my dad passed away when I was a kid, and I was at this time in my late 20s when I had sort of seen how that had shaped my life and shaped the lives of my family members and how that had changed how we kind of interacted with the world and the sort of, you know, the sort of theory of like self relative to society that we had built around that loss. So the story ended up becoming very much about different people who had kind of shaped their identity around loss in different ways. It kind of starts with a premise, but then as you explore that, you kind of see what naturally is coming from you in that.
We're talking with Michael Sarnowski right now, Wisconsinite and director and co-writer of the new film Pig. And Michael, something I really enjoyed about the movie was that it doesn't tell you everything it could. You know, we learn things about the characters' backstories, but there's still plenty of room for us as an audience to think and to kind of fill in the blanks for ourselves. How do you decide what to leave out of a script when you're writing it?
I mean, some of it's trial and error. Some of it you don't decide until you're editing the actual film clips. But for me, kind of my philosophy on it with this project, and I mean, in a lot of my writing, I like the idea that you never really know more about the world than your main character does. So we're going through this from Rob's point of view, and you never really know more than he does. And then beyond that, you never really know more about him than the world does at any given point. We just kind of pick up in the moment and have to kind of figure it out as we go along. And I don't know, there's something about that style of writing that appeals to me. I think it kind of feels how living feels. And that was kind of my guide for how to approach that. But then beyond that, yeah, it's not a movie about grief in the moment. It's not a movie about all the nitty gritty of what happened and why and all of that. It's kind of about the lingering effects of those things. So you don't really need to know all the details to appreciate that on an emotional level. Cause I think when you're dealing with someone and when you're getting to know someone that, you know, has some kind of tragedy, or, I mean, we all have some kind of loss in our past that we're kind of trying to, you know, shape ourselves around or protect ourselves from. I think we're never going to know those immediate things. So we just kind of have to take people at face value and try and connect off of what we can understand.
And speaking of that main character, you were able to cast Nicolas Cage in the lead for this film, Oscar winner, and someone whose acting style over the course of his career has ranged from, you know, kind of over the top to very serious dramatic work. What was it like to work with and direct Nick Cage?
It was surprisingly easy. I wish I had some kind of crazy story to tell, but really, I mean, he read the script. His agents came across the script and became really enthusiastic about it. And he read it and really understood it, really understood the character, really understood the tone of it. So I wasn't having to, you know, wrangle him or make him go smaller or anything like that. Like he really got it on an emotional level. And I think really everyone involved understood it. And so I, you know, it just felt like we were kind of on the same team. He wasn't a diva. He was very professional and collaborative and respectful. I mean, this was my first feature, so he could have, you know, pulled rank and said, this is the Nick Cage show, but mm-hmm. He didn't do that at all. He was very respectful, very much, you know, what does the director want? What is their vision? How do I support that? How do we make this thing happen together? So he was really just a joy to work with. And I don't know, I just really felt like he was a teammate.
Now, Michael, you've gotten this story out there. It's been well-received. If there's someone listening in Wisconsin who has a story they want to tell, whether that's through film or writing or visual art, whatever it may be, but is still thinking about whether to actually, you know, create it and put it out there, what advice would you have for them?
I mean, it sounds hokey, but I would just say go for it. I mean, I thought there were all these barriers into the industry, and there are, but for me, the thing that ended up working was just kind of writing something that I cared about. And I wrote Pig initially to shoot it for very little money, and just kind of, I wrote it as like, okay, if I just have to make my own feature film and just make it happen, I could make this film happen. I could do it guerrilla style. But then, you know, we got some really talented actors involved, and it kind of grew and it became a more legitimate thing. But, you know, I wrote it with the intention of just making it happen if I had to. And I think just think about what you can pull off right now and just try to pull it off. Stop waiting for people to tell you what you should do or can do, and just think about what you want to do.
That's a good place to leave it. Michael, congrats on the film, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Michael Sarnowski is a film director and writer from Wisconsin. He talked to Central Time's Dean Kinetter about his film Pig, which came out earlier this year. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary-Kate McCoy with a story about roadside attractions.
Author Eric Dragne has been a keen observer of roadside attractions for years. He recently wrote the book, The Impossible Road Trip, that chronicles the most famous stops across the U.S., and believe it or not, Wisconsin is home to some of the quirkiest. Dragne takes us on a tour of the best roadside attractions across the state.
I was born in the shadow of the world's largest six-pack in La Crosse. My mom told me later that the nurses in the hospital there even gave her a beer to help bring the milk. Despite this, I realized I'd never conquer the world's largest six-pack, since those six silos hold enough beer to provide one person a six-pack a day for 3,351 years. Being born in Wisconsin, I just assumed these gigantic sculptures of everyday objects were destined to take their rightful place along the roadside to lure in visitors. Then I lived in Italy with all the supposedly tasteful statues and architecture. Later, when Italian friends came to visit me in the Midwest, I tried to show off our impressive architecture. The old churches, the Capitol. They'd respond, "You know, these are all just imitations of Italian buildings. You have seen St. Peter's in Rome, no?" With this in mind, I resolved to show my own kids what is truly American. We set out on the Wisconsin byways. We saw talking cows, rusty dinosaur statues, and too many mice eating cheese to count. A giant bucky badger in Burnham Wood is now half buried next to signs promising hot girls, cold beer. We got lost in the labyrinth of House on the Rock near Spring Green and discovered Dr. Evermore near Baraboo, who gave us a tour of his Forevertron, a Jules Verne-esque steampunk rocket ship before he blasted off into the heavens. A trip into the kitsch world of Wisconsin Dells never disappoints. Except when we discovered that Tommy Bartlett's robot world was brought into the 21st century with no more cheesy 1970s evil robot slaves. And Xanadu, the foam house of tomorrow, has been unceremoniously discarded. Perhaps all that hardened foam from Xanadu was repurposed as the new giant Roman Colosseum next to the upside-down White House. Why just look at some ancient Greek statues and sterile museums when you can drive a go-kart through the belly of a six-story-tall Trojan horse? The best of Wisconsin's roadside attractions come from a burning desire by an obsessed individual to create giant monuments to prove that I was here, like Fred Smith's Concrete Park in Phillips. Even better are those that are the result of a practical joke, such as Rhinelander's Hodag, an elaborate hoax based on the capture of a mythical monster with photos that ran on the front page of newspapers across the country. This is not normal behavior, thank God. And Wisconsin is full of it. Midwestern tourist bureaus drool over the idea of a lucrative roadside attraction, but the best sites are seldom devised by a committee in a boardroom. The creators are artistic visionaries, scorned as kooks and crazies, but are the very ones who give our towns character. Why raise statues to some self-important governor when you can create your own idol, like the 143-foot-long muskie in Hayward? Wouldn't you rather see that than some dusty old Roman statue that's missing its arms? Many of these fiberglass artifacts were born in Sparta at the Fast Company. They made Hayward's muskie, and also a 55-foot half-man, half-peapod Jolly Green Giant in Minnesota, and a 38-foot-tall Holstein in North Dakota that is visible for 5 miles. My family and I visited their graveyard of discarded statues and seriously considered buying an enormous big boy for our front yard. What would the neighbors say? Instead, we put our ambitions aside, realizing we could never compete with the original grandeur of La Crosse's monument to beer.
Eric Dragne is the author of the new book, The Impossible Road Trip, about America's most famous roadside attractions. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
Coming up, we'll get some advice on how to dress up our homes for the holidays while keeping costs to a minimum. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're about a week and a half away from Christmas. If you decorate your yard, you probably already have your lights and other displays out in the front yard for all to see. If not, you've still got time to set things up. And if you don't have a giant Santa, light-up reindeer, or a nativity scene, try making your own. Along with her husband, our next guest has been dressing up her house with her homemade Christmas decorations for decades and winning some awards in the process. She's here to share some of her secrets behind the magic. Nancy Bazin is a resident of South Milwaukee. We talked to her earlier today. Nancy, thanks so much for joining us today.
No problem. It's my pleasure.
Well, paint us a picture, first of all, if you would. What do you have up in your front yard this year?
Well, this year we've toned down decorations a little bit from what we used to do, but this year we still have a theme, which we always tend to do. We have a Santa in a boat, and he's directing reindeers, and we've added on the other end from him, we've added a polar bear with a penguin fishing. And between them, we laid down a tarp of blue plastic, which looks like a river. Behind them, we have like a little camping set. We've got a teepee that my husband made with a little lighted dog coming out. And we've got two elves that they're sitting between, they're between them is like a fire. We've got those bulbs that kind of look like they're flickering, and we made sticks standing up. And so they're kind of like camping along the river. So it's kind of, like I said, all tied in. And that's, you know, besides the lights, of course, and spotlights and stuff, that's pretty much our display. But it's all theme-oriented, which is something we've always done.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about that. You've won awards for your yard displays, and it seems like the theme is really important. That's what separates the award winner from somebody who just throws a whole bunch of stuff that they bought in the front yard. How important is it to have that theme for you?
For us, it's always been theme-oriented, no matter what, like... When we first started, we had a Santa suit, and that's from trying to be Santa when the kids were little. So what we had done from there is we used it to stuff him. And our first, very, very first theme was we had in our yard, and it wasn't on a very busy street, but my husband had built like a little A-frame treehouse for our kids. So we got the idea of stuffing Santa, and he's crawling up the ladder. And then below him, my husband did life-size, like, reindeer. You know, we had logs from our place up north and stuff. And so they were, like, eating hay below. So that kind of started out. It's kind of the theme. You know, he's going up either to rest or visit the kids that are sleeping in the house. And then we went from there. And it would be, we tended to use our Santa Claus pretty much in everything. And we stuffed that suit, whether we had him sitting at a table or at a desk, rather. And then we went and stuffed kids' clothes, like snow suits and stuff. And they were standing in line to sit on Santa's lap. That's what it was. He was sitting on a chair and they were standing in line. So we've kind of always gone around that way. Santa, like I said, that suit went many, many years. It withstood all of the all of the weather. And again, just as well as the clothes that we would get to stuff our kids. Then from kids, we've added elves. Okay, so we did that with stuffed like red pants or green pants, anything we could find out, whether rummage sales or stuff like that. As we progressed, one of the things we used is in trying to keep things stuffed is we used a styrofoam head, because you could put the hats on them. You could put scarves around their faces, because none of them really had faces. You know, you kind of turned them to the side, but you could always tell what they were. We always did them life size. So that kind of was the theme through the year, either bringing in elves and always having Santa and using stuffed clothes and things like that.
You it's not just stuffing the clothes. You make, and over the years you've made a lot of your props and decorations as opposed to buying them. What got you into that sort of do-it-yourself angle?
Well, you know, my husband is very, very handy. And even though sometimes he makes faces when I would come up with ideas, a couple days later he would always go, oh, we can do this. So as we progressed, you know, you find different things come out to use. So what he did to make things easier for our figures would be he made kind of a stick person. So you had that stick going up so you could put the styrofoam head. And then you had kind of like stick arms that you could dress, and then the arms could be, you know, the arms could be molded. Same thing with the feet. You could put the pants on. So as we progressed, that's what we used as far as our people went. As far as the rest of the decorations, we would use stuff like we would cut out, let's say plywood, or it's not fiberboard, but something like that. And then we would paint it. We made lollipops, okay, with the spirals. We used those all around a skating rink that we had. And then the next year we would use those lollipops in a different kind of a themed thing. So some of our things that we made carried through to the, you know, we carried them through to the next year. We always tried to reuse whatever we can, but make it a different theme.
When do you have to start doing all this work to have it ready by December?
Well, you know what? We weren't always like, doing this stuff in summer. Summer got to be busy. So I'd love to say, oh my God, we planned all year. We didn't. We would do it, you know, we would do it just as we had time. So sometimes the stuff was started, you know, maybe early part of November. You know what I mean? It always got done. But the ideal thing would be plan what you can. But, you know, life gets busy, so it just depends on what time you have. But I do believe that if you have the time to start it when it is nice weather and everybody can be involved and you're not out there freezing your fingers and your toes and your nose, that's the best thing to do.
You mentioned the weather. It's not going to be so nice today. What do you do when you know some heavy winds are blowing in?
Well, especially with the inflatables, we already have them extra tied anyway. Because, you know, what's the theme if you don't have the inflatable or it's sideways or Santa's on his head or, you know, or the boat like we have is capsized? We do have it tied down in a bunch of different ways, like added stability. But now with something like this, it would just be foolish. There's no reason to turn around and wreck, you know, we've got the whole season yet. So we just don't put anything with inflatable. We don't. And anything that's kind of, say, more stabilized that, you know, isn't blowing up, you just kind of make sure you have it tied down. That's, I guess you do the best you can do because you don't want to put all that work up and have it be gone or in the neighbor's yard and have them taking credit for it.
Just in our last few moments, are you thinking about next year already?
You know what? We kind of all, it depends on what I see. This is all, you know, what can we add? What can we improve on? So it's kind of something that just comes along as I see it or think about it.
Nancy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you very, very much, and Merry Christmas.
And to you, too.
Thank you.
Nancy Bazin is a South Milwaukee resident. We talked to her about her and her husband's award-winning homemade Christmas decorations. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, with concern about inflation, the Federal Reserve is looking at possible action. We'll get the basics on what the Fed is, what it does, and what it can do when it comes to inflation. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.